Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Between 1846 and 1873, California's Indian population plunged from perhaps 150,000 to just 30,000. In his new book, An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873, today's guest, Benjamin Madley, calls the near annihilation of the California Indians a genocide sanctioned and facilitated by California officials. He writes, quote, "Recording the numbers of California Indian people killed is not a mere academic exercise. As anyone who has ever lost a loved one knows, the death of a single person is a profound loss. Recording how many California Indians were killed between 1846 and 1873 is, in part, an attempt to understand the magnitude of the rupture and profound pain caused by their loss. Each murder severed personal, familial, and tribal links. In the context of genocide, recording deaths also signifies the slain and gives a voice to the departed." End quote. Benjamin Madley is assistant professor of history at UCLA and a historian of Native America, the United States, and genocide in world history. His new book is An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe. And Benjamin Madley joins me from the studios of UCLA. Hi, Benjamin. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Rose. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. I have to say, on a personal note, my grandmother just passed, who was a California Indian. And so I really thank you for writing this. Huge respect. It was a massive undertaking. The book itself is 359 pages. The notes and bibliography are 111 pages. And then you also include meticulous details about killings, a massive 187 pages. Why did you decide to take on such a massive project?
Well, I grew up in Karuk Indian country in far northern California as a boy. And then when we moved to Los Angeles, I began to attend a large public high school here. And one day while I was taking a German class, anthropologists and archaeologists showed up on site and said, "This is an ancient Tongva village site and a sacred spot." And at the same time, the discussions were beginning at University High School about removing the Plains Indian warrior as the school's mascot. And that discussion eventually became the discussion about eliminating mascots in Los Angeles as a whole. Now, while all that was going on, I began to wonder, what happened to all of the Indians? Years later, when I was a PhD student at Yale, one morning I was walking through the Woolsey Rotunda, which is a spectacular marble room on which there are the names of all of the Yale men who have fallen in all of the wars since Yale existed. And I stopped there. I paused for a moment. I thought, we need something like this for California Indian people. And we need something like a kind of Vietnam memorial for Indian people. Mm. And obviously, I'm not a sculptor or a creator of artistic things like Maya Lin. So as an historian, what I tried to do was bring some dignity and some memory of these vast crimes by creating this massive appendix that lists every single killing of a California Indian person that I could find. And the numbers are, well, they're staggering. Somewhere between 9,000 and over 16,000, probably many more California Indian people were killed during this period, to say nothing of the thousands of others who starved to death on reservations or died of exposure while hiding out from the killers in the mountains, or who died of diseases, or all of the other factors that colonialism brought to California during this period.
Why did you decide to focus on the years between 1846 and 1873?
Well, 1846 is the year that the United States invaded California and took it from Mexico. So that's the beginning of the violence. It's also the year of the first major massacre committed by U.S. forces. 1873 marks a closure of sorts in that that is the end of the last major killing campaign against California Indian people. The 1872-1873 Modoc War came to a bitter conclusion when the United States hanged and then decapitated the four major resistance leaders from the Modoc Nation and sent their heads off to be stored in Washington, D.C.
People from more than a dozen American Indian nations helped you with your research, interpretations, and conclusions. Can you talk about how you went about doing your research?
That's a terrific question that no one's asked me before. One of the things that I wanted to do in this project was to closely engage with as many indigenous communities as possible. This is not an oral history-based project. It's a project based on written documents. But I wanted to engage with communities, and so what I did was I visited places like Smith River Rancheria in northwestern California many different times in order to present my material. And the things that I learned from elders and from tribal leaders were really tremendous, because California Indian communities' histories are not only written, they are also oral histories. So I'll give you an example. At Smith River, somebody told me about a period of time when all of the villages were on fire. And because their oral histories are so specific, they were able to tell me that this was in the early 1850s. So I began to look hard for evidence from that period, and I actually found a travelogue by an Austrian female travel writer. She was there. She went from San Francisco up to what is now Del Norte County, and she hired a guide, a Swiss miner, and she actually saw all of these villages. She saw villages that had been burned down, and she saw white vigilantes actually in the process of burning villages down. There are also many correctives that I learned by visiting indigenous communities. I learned that things had been mislabeled, people had been misnamed. And so this was also not only a way to create a more accurate historical narrative, but also a way for me to share with indigenous communities. So I've done talks for Indian Health Services to increase the cultural competency of those working in Indian country in California. But I've also worked with tribes on programs for youth and providing more information for them to understand their past. Because so many people were killed, the oral history links were severed in many cases. So we don't have a full picture in every community of what happened, because in many cases, massacres left no survivors or only small children who were often then enslaved or taken away as indentures to work in the households of white families.
You write that mass death silenced thousands of California Indian voices, but so did California laws and judges. Mid-19th century California courts usually barred and rarely recorded Indian testimony against whites. Outside the legal system, few 19th century writers recorded California Indians' words either. Moreover, you write, in the face of ongoing discrimination, violence, and intimidation, those who survived often hid their Indian identities and their traumatic memories from outsiders, and that's why we have so little information about this.
That's right. Now, when state legislators in California convened for the first time, one of their very first acts was to silence Indian participation in the political system by banning Indians from voting, barring those of one half of Indian blood or more from giving evidence for or against whites in criminal cases, and denying Indians the right to serve as jurors. And soon thereafter, they also banned Indian people from serving as attorneys. So what you're talking about is how California's legal system shut Indians out of participation in and protection by our state's legal system. And this amounted to a virtual grant of impunity to those who attacked them. Mm. So this was a major precursor to the killing and a facilitator of this mass murder program.
And just quickly, going back to the research process, what really struck you about the conversations you had with American Indians when you approached them and told them about this project and then spent time with them and asked them questions? What really stands out for you about that experience?
A couple of things. One was the fact that most California Indian elders that I spoke with took genocide for granted as an appropriate interpretive lens for these catastrophic events. And that surprised me. But I came to understand that that's quite common, that most California Indian communities see their history during this period as a history of enduring genocide. The other thing that struck me was how, in a certain way, the pain of being in a community that has suffered genocide is specific to that community. We can't necessarily universalize and say that Jewish communities' experience of remembering and thinking about the Holocaust is anything like California Indian communities remembering and thinking about genocide here. But I think that one of the key reasons for that is that still, even today, neither the U.S. government nor the state of California has acknowledged that the California catastrophe fits the legal definition of genocide set forth by the United Nations in 1948. Hmm. And that makes the pain much worse, because when you suffer a trauma and society as a whole tells you that, no, you didn't actually suffer that trauma, it's much more painful.
You know, I think this is so interesting. And you write in your book a lot about the definition of genocide, the Holocaust, what this all means. Why don't we have more museums? Why don't we teach this in school? And I often think about this. I mean, we have Holocaust museums in every major city in this country. The same definitely does not apply to Native Americans. In fact, when the American Indian Museum was built in Washington, D.C., there was a huge debate about how far they should go, right? How much information should they provide to the public? How much of it should be deep and intense? The American Indian movement was angry because the word Holocaust is not in the museum. So, you know, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, even here in San Francisco, the Ohlone people are trying so hard to build a community center, but they just can't really get anywhere. I'm sure funding is huge, but they're having a really hard time, you know, getting this thing off the ground.
Well, one of the problems is that most people in the government and in the public sphere aren't aware of this genocide. Mm. What this book argues is that it's absolutely not an exaggeration to say that the state of California, in combination with the federal government, established a state-sponsored killing machine. And tracing the state's role, both federal and state actors, is one of the primary things that this book does. So, for example, it carefully narrates the histories of the 24 state militia expeditions that were launched between 1850 and 1861 that killed at least 1,340 California Indian people, and which were directly funded by the state legislators through three major bills in the 1850s that raised up to $1.51 million to fund these operations. And at the same time, very few people have known before the publication of this book that the United States Army and their auxiliaries actually killed even more people than the state militia did. They killed at least 1,680 California Indians between 1846 and 1873, and maybe as many as 3,000 or more. At the same time, the federal government was very much a part of supporting those militia expeditions. The federal government, our United States Congress, reimbursed the state of California nearly $1 million for those killing campaigns. And if you think that these operators, these generals or these militia commanders were rogue operators, you need only look at the fact that the United States Congress and the legislature of the state of California repeatedly voted to support these operations. And really, endorsement by our state's leaders was only very thinly veiled. I'll just give you an example. In 1851, our very first democratically elected state governor, a man named Peter Burnett, declared that, and I'll quote, "A war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct." Mm. And people in Washington, D.C., in Congress, knew about these positions, because the very next year, Senator John Weller, who became our state's governor in 1858, went even further. He told his fellow U.S. senators that California Indians, and I'll quote again, "will be exterminated before the onward march of the white man." And Weller argued that, and I'll quote again, "the interest of the white man demands their extinction." So this was not a hidden secret proposition. The genocide that was going on in California was publicized in the newspapers. It was reported in government official letters. So people knew. In fact, I guess you could say it was hidden in plain sight. So if we come to a place where this is part of public knowledge, I hope it will be part of a larger public discussion that may, in fact, lead to monuments, days of remembrance, radical changes in our state's public school curricula, and ultimately a public discussion about what this means for the history of California and for the history of Native America, and ultimately for the history of these United States.
Benjamin Madley is assistant professor of history at UCLA and a historian of Native America, the United States, and genocide in world history. His new book is An American Genocide, the United States, and the California Indian Catastrophe. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls, but I hope you go to our website to read more about this book and find out how you can get your hands on it. It was a massive undertaking, massive, massive book. And Benjamin, since we're talking about education, what did you learn about Native Americans when you were in school?
Well, I went to school here in California, and unfortunately, like many children in this state, I didn't learn very much about California Indian people. But I had the very fortunate experience of spending much of my childhood in Karuk country, so I was able to see as a boy the ongoing conflicts between natives and newcomers over political sovereignty, over equal treatment before the law, issues like driving while Indian, and, of course, debates over how to care for our forests and our rivers and our environment. So I guess I had a relatively unusual upbringing that way, but my hope is that this book might catalyze a meaningful conversation about doing more in our state's curricular standards beyond the fourth grade and the building of a few dioramas or maybe a model mission made out of sugar cubes.
And as an academic, how do you go about changing the curriculum to include this information?
Well, the issue of genocide in California during this period obviously poses explosive political, economic, and educational questions, not just for the state of California, but for California's tribes, both its 110 federally recognized tribes and the 70-plus communities that are not federally recognized, as well as individual California Indians. And because the ramifications are so tightly connected to Indian experiences here, I think that it's really up to indigenous people, California Indians, not academics like me, to set the agenda for what are the most important issues and what the best way forward is.
It seems like there's so much awareness raising around Black Lives Matter, of course. You know, there's the protest at the Dakota, for the Dakota Access Pipeline, Standing Rock, North Dakota. A lot more books are coming out about Native Americans. Just in the last 2 years, there have been so many. What do you think's happening? It seems like we're at a point where we are starting this conversation. The question is, will we see concrete changes?
We obviously have a long way to go here in the United States on the issue of race relations. Some political candidates may wish to obfuscate and hide from that fact, but I think these are very, very real, crucial issues. The Dakota Access Pipeline issue reveals how far we have to go. It's very difficult for me to imagine attack dogs and private security officers attacking women and children, peaceful protesters, simply protesting for the protection of a basic necessity of life, that is clean water, protesting for the basic human dignity not to have the remains of their ancestors dug up and desecrated. And yet these peaceful protesters, including women and children and elders, were set upon by private security contractors and attack dogs. It's hard to imagine that happening to Euro-Americans in this day and age. But clearly it's a major problem still, and it's a problem that academics, I think, are increasingly aware of. And in our work as historians, you know, I and others, I think, hope to reveal the historical roots of these patterns of exploitation and abuse and the fundamental injustice of a political system that largely denies American Indian people, even today, full equal access and equal opportunity before the law.
And since we're talking about this oil pipeline, I just want to mention one fact. The PBS NewsHour reported this, but I have really not heard it anywhere else. The $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline's original path crossed the Missouri River north of Bismarck, which is a city that's 90% white. But when concerns were raised about a potential oil spill there, the pipeline was rerouted south to go under the river next to the Standing Rock Reservation. And the Missouri River is the tribe's primary source of drinking water. Now, as a journalist, I think that this information should be included in every story. Unfortunately, it's not.
Yes, I think that it's quite clear that Standing Rock community was targeted because they probably thought that they would not resist. And the show of support has been overwhelming. I believe that over 250 American Indian communities have sent representatives there. Some of our own UCLA indigenous community members were recently there as part of the protests. And there is a public consciousness about this beyond Indian country. Multiple cities, city councils, have passed resolutions supporting the Standing Rock community and taking a stance against the pipeline. In fact, I believe some major metropolitan areas like Seattle that have stood up against this.
Before we go to break, can you talk a little bit more about your experiences visiting Native Americans today? Because I would venture to guess that the majority of the population has never been to an Indian reservation. And I was visiting Montana back in 2005, right outside of Glacier National Park with the Blackfeet Reservation. And in 2005, this tribe finally got paved roads and mailboxes. And most people didn't believe me when I told them this, but this is the reality that so many people who live on Indian reservations face today.
Well, it's a very shameful part of our past, but it's also a very shameful part of our future and our present, unless we take action to change things. There are American Indian communities still in this country who do not have access to clean running water in their homes. California's Indian communities are some of the poorest communities in California. The town in which I grew up, Happy Camp, has one of the highest rates of welfare of any established town or city in the entire state. That said, California Indian people are at the same time undergoing a tremendous renaissance. There is a great deal of cultural renewal happening. There are grammar books being written. Languages are being revitalized. Ceremonies are coming back. And people are engaging increasingly with the federal government. To give you one example, the U.S. Forest Service now employs some California Indian people to help manage our state's forests using old, practiced, proven methods of fire-based land management. So when I think about my experiences in California Indian communities, I see a tremendous amount of pain and trauma, but at the same time, I see an amazing resilience. And when you think about how people survived this genocide, it is really incredible. People survived against almost impossible odds. We saw an 80% plus population decrease during the years that I describe in this book, and yet people found ways not to be killed. People hid in the forest. They integrated themselves in the larger colonial community. They found ways to survive. So against the backdrop of the genocide, there is also a flip side, which is tremendous heroic resistance against, you know, like I said, really all but impossible odds.
Benjamin Madley is author of An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe. He focuses on the years 1846 and 1873, the years between those time periods. This is your call. This is a pre-taped show, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls, and we'll be back after this.
On the next Your Call, we'll revisit our conversation with Rhys Jones about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. Over the past decade, 40,000 people have died trying to cross international borders. And Rhys argues these deaths are not exceptional. They're the result of government attempts to contain population and control access to resources. Learn more about violent borders from Rhys Jones on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, I'm speaking with Benjamin Madley about his new book, An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe. Benjamin is the professor of history at UCLA and a historian of Native America, the United States, and genocide in world history. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take your phone calls, but you can find out more information about Benjamin's book at yourcallradio.org. Benjamin, before the break, you were talking about how Native Americans survived this genocide. And, you know, I can't help but think about my California ancestors. They were Pomo who lived up in Ukiah. And historians have often told me, well, the reason why they survived is because they didn't live near gold country. If they lived near gold country, you probably wouldn't be here today. I mean, that's kind of intense to hear.
Well, what's remarkable about that is the ignorance of Pomo history that suggests. The U.S. Army's first major sustained killing campaign against California Indian people actually took place in Pomo country. Late in 1849, two ranchers who were holding Pomo and Wapo people as slaves and abusing them terribly, systematically raping women, torturing people to death, starving people to death. People on their ranch at what is now Kelseyville. Kelseyville is named after one of them. Indian people rose up and killed these two horrible slave owners. And in response, the United States sent out a series of campaigns against them. The most violent was led by a man who later became a U.S. Army general named Nathaniel Lyon. And when they reached Clear Lake, just over the ridges from Ukiah, they committed a major massacre at a place now known as Bloody Island, killing hundreds of people. Some estimates think as many as 800 people died there that morning. They then marched over to the Russian River and down the valley, and at Ukiah committed another major massacre, which Nathaniel Lyon described in his official report as, I quote, a perfect slaughter pen. They then marched south down the Russian River Valley, killing more people. And the killing itself is remarkable, given that they targeted communities that clearly had nothing whatsoever to do with the murders that took place at Kelseyville. But what's also remarkable about that particular killing campaign was the official response to it. You would think that after killing large numbers of innocent civilians, military officials would at least censure the officers involved, but instead they were all promoted. Several of them later became U.S. generals, and the artillery commander who was involved in that killing campaign later became governor of the state of California. So I think that it's quite inaccurate to say that the killing only happened in the gold fields. Many California Indian communities who were dozens or even hundreds of miles away from the gold fields were mercilessly slaughtered in an attempt to physically exterminate them.
I'm so glad we're talking about this because a lot of people think that most of the killings took place either near gold country or they happened along the missions in California, along the California coast. But that's just not the case. I mean, you have so much documentation of in your book about tribes who were nowhere near the gold country or missions, and they still were slaughtered.
That's right. Massacres happened all over the state. We find massacres along the Arizona border, on the Colorado River, massacres in northeastern California, near Goose Lake, hard by the Nevada border. So they really appeared all over. It is accurate to say, though, that more of the killings happened away from the coastal mission-affected zone than in that zone, in part because during the mission period, there was a massive population crash in those coastal regions, particularly from San Francisco south to the Mexican border. We know from mission records, in fact, that over 60,000 people died in the 21 missions out of the 80,000 some who were baptized. So that massively depopulated those zones.
There were a lot of things in your book that were hard to read, but I think the sexual assault was one of the worst. You write that colonist sexual assaults inflicted further violence and pain on California Indians during the mission period. As early as 1772, Father Luis Jaime Orjamia of Mission San Diego reported hearing that local Indians, probably, is it Ipay or Taipei? Is that how you say it?
Ipai
or Tipai people, quote, leave their huts and the crops which they gather and go to the woods and experience hunger. They do this so that the soldiers will not rape their women, as they have already done so many times in the past, end quote. He also received multiple eyewitness reports of gang rapes and concluded of Spanish soldiers, quote, very many of them deserve to be hanged on account of the continuous outrages which they are committing in seizing and raping the women. There is not a single mission where all the Gentiles have not been scandalized, end quote. The following year, Junipero Serra himself wrote, and he was canonized by the Pope last year, quote, the soldiers, clever as they are at lassoing cows and mules, would catch an Indian woman with their lassos to become prey for their lust. At times, some Indian men would try to defend their wives only to be shot with bullets. I mean, this is just horrific.
Right. So this pattern of sexual abuse and naked sexual aggression toward indigenous people, and children and men were also sometimes abused during the mission period, established a pattern of dehumanization and mistreatment and legal subjugation, treating California's indigenous people as subjects with few or no rights. That continued into the U.S. period. Sexual abuse was a crucial part of the genocide. Let me first explain what I mean by that and then talk about some of the genocidal crimes. So the definition that I'm using in the book is the United Nations Genocide Convention of 1948. And it really has a two-part definition of the crime. First, perpetrators have to demonstrate intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And second, they have to commit one of five genocidal acts listed in the convention. So beyond premeditated, systematic killings, other acts of genocide proliferated. Now, many, many rapes and beatings occurred. And these meet the UN Genocide Convention's definition of what they call causing serious bodily harm to victims on the basis of their group identity and with the intent to destroy the group. Meanwhile, the sustained military and civilian policy of demolishing California Indian villages and their food stores while driving survivors into inhospitable, you know, colder, wetter mountain regions with little food amounted to another crime enumerated in the convention, that is, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Further, if you think about it, malnutrition and exposure predictably lower communal birth rates. So some state and federal decision makers also appear guilty of another crime enumerated by the convention, and that is the crime of imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Finally, and this is also a very important argument in the book, the state of California, slave raiders, and federal officials were all involved in another crime enumerated by the convention, and that is the crime of forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And the numbers are just staggering. Scholars estimate that 3,000 to 4,000 or more California Indian children suffered these kinds of forced transfers. Now, by breaking up families and communities, forced removals constituted another act of imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. So, in effect, the state legalized abduction and enslavement of Indian youth. Slavers exploited the indenture laws that were on the books, and federal officials then prevented the United States Army officers and their troops in California from intervening to protect the victims. So rape and other kinds of physical assaults are just one kind of genocidal crime that we see perpetrated again and again and again in California under U.S. rule.
And why, from a historian's perspective, is it so important to use the word genocide? You write that exceptionalist interpretations of U.S. history, which suggest that the United States is fundamentally unlike other countries, lose validity when researchers compare the California experience to other genocides and place it within global frameworks.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's at stake. One of the questions is a question of public acknowledgement or apology. The kind of things that Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush did in the 1980s to acknowledge the relocation and internment of some 120,000 Japanese Americans, by the way, many of whom were California citizens during the Second World War. A connection to that is immediate. You think of reparations. They're an important subordinate issue. So if we call it genocide, we have to ask, should state and federal officials offer compensation? Should they offer compensation along the lines of the more than $1.6 billion that Congress has now paid out to over 82,000 of these Japanese Americans and their heirs? Another question we might want to consider is, might California officials decrease or altogether eliminate their cut of California Indians' annual gaming revenues? And these are substantial, by the way. California Indian gaming generated over $7.3 billion of income in 2014. Should the state or federal government agencies return control to California's Indian communities of state or federal lands where these genocidal events took place? For example, you know, we have over 300 documented massacre sites throughout the state of California, and many of these sites are now on state or federal land. You know, should the state and federal government stop commemorating the supporters and perpetrators of this genocide? People like Peter Burnett, who I mentioned before, Kit Carson and John C. Fremont, who directly perpetrated mass murder, or Stanford, who helped to fund one of the major killing campaigns. And then, of course, as we mentioned before, will these events, if we call them genocide, now join other genocides, the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, in the state's public school curricula and in our public discourse? Now, you ask why, you know, those are sort of the practical considerations. And again, I think it's really for California Indian communities and individuals to figure out which of those issues they think are the most important and that they want to lead with. But I can tell you where my thinking comes from as an historian and as a human being passionately concerned with studying this. I devoted the better part of a decade of my life to this project. Mm. The first thing that just comes from the heart is decency. Even long after the people are gone, I think it's decent. It's basic decency to preserve the truth of what happened to them. Not only so that their memory can be honored, but so that the repetition of similar genocidal crimes can be deterred. So the second thing that I think of is justice. Justice demands, I think, that even long after the perpetrators have also vanished, we document and tell the stories of the crimes that they and their supporters have, in our state's case, so successfully concealed, denied, and suppressed. And finally, as an historian, veracity demands, at least for me, that we acknowledge this state-sponsored catastrophe in all of its varied aspects and all of its causes in order to better understand formative events in both the history of the state of California and the United States, in order to better understand where we are today and how we got here.
Today I'm speaking with Benjamin Madley, author of An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe. Benjamin is assistant professor of history at UCLA and a historian of Native America, the United States, and genocide in world history. As he said, he spent a decade working on this massive book. He writes, "The story of the California Indian Catastrophe is almost unrelentingly grim, which helps to explain why relatively little has been written about it, at least compared to other genocides." This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls, but you can find out more about this important book at yourcallradio.org. As you said, Benjamin, it's got to take Native Americans to really make these changes. And, you know, with the death of my grandparents recently, I can't help but think about what role I should play in trying to do this, to raise awareness about these issues. And I think a lot about the fact that, you know, when you look at Black Lives Matter, there are a lot of prominent African Americans who write about these issues, are in the media on a regular basis. The same goes for Jews. The same does not go for Native Americans. I just found this graphic looking at the employees of National Public Radio. I mean, I work for an NPR affiliate. We're not included. But at NPR, there are zero Native Americans. I mean, when I went to college, I think I was the only Native American. So the fact of the matter is, Native Americans still do not have prominent positions in society to raise awareness about these issues. Isn't that part of the problem?
Yes. Well, you know, as an educator, I think about the educational sphere, and it's quite a glaring issue for the University of California system that indigenous people in our state's university system are dramatically underrepresented, not only among faculty, but among students as well. And American Indian students struggle with a lot of issues, and one of the sad realities is that American Indians in the UC system have the lowest rate of graduation of any group that the UCs track. I'm very fortunate to be at UCLA and to be chair of a thriving American Indian Studies program here. We are unusual in that we have a master's degree in American Indian Studies. We have a major and a minor in American Indian Studies.
Wow.
We have a thriving American Indian Studies Center and even an American Indian Studies Library.
Hmm.
It's one of the reasons that I came here.
Wow.
But my hope is that we could have the same type of institutional development at all of our UCs. There are more American Indian people living in California, in fact, than in any other state in the Union. Not only 150,000 California Indian people from 110 federally recognized tribes and 70 unrecognized tribes, but also people from hundreds of different American communities, both within and beyond the United States. So one of the beginnings that we have to address is equal access for Native American people in our universities, in order to develop more leaders.
How did this come about? I mean, who pushed for an American Indian Studies program? Who pushed for the library? How did this happen?
Well, this all began in 1969, but it seemed to really thrive here at UCLA in an extraordinary way. One of the issues that we have is enrollment numbers, and we've been very successful with building our programs. In fact, we have this year here more students enrolled as majors and minors in American Indian Studies and in our American Indian Studies MA program than we have ever had in our entire history. I believe the number is 43.
Wow.
But when you compare that to other programs, not only here but at other universities around the country, these numbers are very small.
Today we're speaking with Benjamin Madley, author of An American Genocide, the United States, and the California Indian Catastrophe. Between 1846 and 1873, California's Indian population plunged from 150,000 to 30,000. Benjamin is chair of the American Indian Studies Program at UCLA, historian of Native America, the United States, and genocide in world history. And we have just about 5 or so minutes left, and I want to spend some time talking about life before the Europeans arrived, because you just do such a great work, such a great job of reporting on the natural bounty and the languages. And I just think this is so important because the visuals are just really rich. You write that California, on the eve of contact with Europeans, was an exuberant clamor of Native American economies, languages, tribes, and individuals. Indigenous people had worshipped, loved, traded, and fought in California for at least 12,000 years, some believe since time immemorial. What really struck you about what you learned when you looked at life before the Europeans arrived?
Well, let me just zoom in on one thing you mentioned. Languages. There are hundreds of thousands of California Indian people before contact, and they spoke just this dazzling array of languages. So let me give you some context. In North America, before Columbus, we're looking at a very diverse linguistic landscape. Indigenous people between, let's say, the Rio Grande River and the Arctic Ocean spoke about 300 different languages that can be classified into more than 50 different language families. Now, in contrast, Europeans' languages can be classified into as few as just three families. So amid this already incredibly varied linguistic landscape, pre-contact California stands out as one of the most linguistically diverse places on the planet.
Wow.
California Indians before contact spoke maybe 100 separate languages that are classified by linguists into at least 5 different language families, some of them as mutually unintelligible, according to one scholar, as Chinese is from English. And that gives you a sense of how rich and diverse and complex this California world before contact was. So they're speaking scores of different languages, and they're creating dozens of cultural and political units. Anthropologists, for example, recognize at least 60 major tribes in California, and these they in turn subdivide into many more linguistic and tribal subgroups. So your Pomo people, for example, anthropologists classify into 7 different particular ethno-linguistic subgroups. And many California subgroups can then be further divided into, scholars think, approximately somewhere around 500 individual bands. And this is particular to California in a way, in that each of these villages or village constellations tended to act as its own politically and economically autonomous entity. So indigenous peoples in California were highly independent, but at the same time, they were loosely bound to these larger tribal linguistic groups. They shared languages, they shared religions, they shared cultures. But they're also all linked to each other by complex systems of exchange. If you look, for example, at a map of California, look at I-5, and you see the state highways, you see the interstates, those, most of them are built directly on top of ancient trading routes that linked all of these hundreds of California Indian communities together.
You also write, and I love this part, traded foods included acorns, beans, berries, fish, meat, nuts, roots, salt, seafood, seaweed, and seeds. And then luxuries included tobacco and pipes, woodpecker scalps, ornamental shelves, carved nuts, and pigments. And I think this is also really important because when we do talk about Native Americans at the sort of national level, a lot of people say, well, let's not romanticize Native Americans. They also killed each other. They had tribal war. And you write that California Indians did have violent conflicts with each other before contact with Europeans, but warfare does not seem to have dominated their lives. As early as 1875, ethnographer Stephen Powers remarked that California Indians, quote, were not a martial race, but rather peaceable, end quote. Can you talk more about what you learned about that?
Yes. Warfare that Europeans brought to California staggered California Indians, because most of them did not have a warring tradition. Most of them did not have complex warrior societies, as you see in some other parts of the Americas. And they definitely did not have genocide. There are no there's no evidence of entire villages being wiped out by other Indian communities in the pre-contact period, no evidence that I'm aware of. And many of them had a tradition of stopping a battle as soon as anyone was hurt. So they were not prepared for the kind of devastating total war that disregarded civilian life that Europeans and U.S. citizens brought to California with the Gold Rush.
You just don't hear about that very often. There is an idea out there, a widely held belief, that Native Americans were constantly at war with each other.
Yeah, I think really, you know, California before contact was this thriving, staggeringly diverse place with a lot going on. But major wars and sustained warfare was not a big part of that history, I don't think. Not that I'm aware of.
And Benjamin, we have just about a minute left. What are you hoping comes from this book?
I hope that we will begin to discuss these painful topics. They're not going to be easy. They are going to be painful. But we need to move closer to understanding the trauma of American Indian history as part of the United States. By coming closer to these events and instead of hiding them, bringing them out into the open, I think we will ultimately create a clearer, more nuanced picture of the tapestry of Native American life and experience in this country. But we will also, all of us, both Native and non-Native, gain a clearer understanding both of our past and ourselves.
Benjamin Madley is author of An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe. Benjamin is chair of the American Indian Studies Department at UCLA and a historian of Native America, the United States, and genocide in world history. Benjamin, thank you so much for doing such extensive research, dedicating a decade of your life to writing this important book. And thank you for joining us. And we'd love to have you back again.
Rose, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Thank you.
On the next Your Call, we'll revisit our conversation with Rees Jones about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. Over the past decade, 40,000 people have died trying to cross international borders. And Rees argues these deaths are not exceptional. They're the result of government attempts to contain population and control access to resources. Learn more about Violent Borders from Rees Jones on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.